I think today's discussion is a little bit of a carryover from a previous conversation that we had about a month ago regarding breaking free of anti-China psyops, some of the elements of how China kicked out George Soros back in the 1980s. You know, Russia took them a lot longer. Russia got annihilated in the 1990s under what's today known as Perestroika or Operation Hammer that we had also discussed, the liberalization, privatization of the entire Russian economy and the creation of a new class, a new breed of Russian oligarchs that were just selected because they were willing puppets, little sociopaths who were more than happy to serve the interests of the City of London, of Wall Street, of the IMF as part of a takedown of essentially Russian civilization as we know it, and the creation of a new technocratic feudal structure that was designed originally in the 1990s. When you listen to people like Zbigniew Brzezinski, the idea was to always balkanize all of Russia, not just the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact territories, but all of the Russian state as we know it, into effectively 13 or 14 micro federations that would all be dominated by one or another ethno-national prejudiced group that would always be under a state of constant turmoil, constant divide to conquer, and thus better looted as a slave colony, the way Hitler had wanted to use Russia back in the 1940s as an extraction zone governed by local managers, you know, neo-Trotskyites, for example, that wanted to kill Stalin and bring back the Trotsky deep state in Russia that was working very closely with the Japanese fascists, British, French, and especially German Nazi fascists. That was always the agenda back then. It didn't work out back in the 30s and 40s when it was originally attempted. It didn't work in the 20s when Trotsky was managing the liberalization of the Russian economy under with the help of people like Armand Hammer, the original hammer around which the Operation Hammer under George Bush Sr. was given the name in the 1990s. So that didn't work. But in China, there was a pushback in the 80s against this whole operation. It didn't go the way of Russia. So we only scratched the surface. And I know you wanted to really tackle the question of Tiananmen Square, because that does play a big role. And today we're a few days away from the anniversary of the Tiananmen Square events. I'll say events because most people refer to it as a massacre, where thousands and thousands of innocent, peaceful student protesters were, we are told, killed by the big bad Chinese Communist Party on June 4th. All they wanted was liberty. Give me liberty or give me death. American flag, Statue of Liberty. All of these things were in Tiananmen Square in Beijing between April and June of 1989. I make the point, and many authors who I'm going to be citing today have made the point pretty conclusively, especially using material from WikiLeaks that went public a decade ago, never got much circulation by mainstream press, that this is a hoax. There was never such a thing as a Tiananmen Square massacre. What it was, on deeper analysis and with an appreciation for global oligarchical operations and the fight to kick out George Soros that happened in the wake of this from China, is that it was more like a Maidan, the thing that we saw in Ukraine that utilized violent provocateurs, killing both police as well as useful idiot protesters who didn't know why they were being corralled to demand changes in the government in Ukraine and Kiev in 2013 and 14. They didn't realize how they were being used. And this is very similar as a process to what we saw then. So I'm going to do a share screen. So as you see, there is a quick little screenshot of one of the scenes, give me liberty or give me death. A statement directly referencing the American Revolution, right in front behind that is Chairman Mao in Tiananmen Square. This is one of the most iconic images that we're given. The brave, freedom-loving student staring down the big bad tankers who were out killing student protesters. What a brave and courageous guy who probably died. I always thought he died up until I started researching this thing. I actually, in my memory, it was burnt into my head that he had died as had thousands of others. The reality is, people could watch the video clips. He literally walks onto this fellow walking with his groceries, steps onto the tank, looks around for about 3 seconds, then walks down and walks away. That's literally what happened. That's the video. So just some samples of modern color revolutions, just to remind people how today's asymmetrical warfare, how it operates, what are the tactics of regime change, hard and soft alike. We know what the hard regime change, we know what that looks like. We saw it in the form of Iraq, of Afghanistan. We saw it in Libya with the direct, humanitarian bombing campaigns that were designed to essentially democracy build. That's what George Bush and Dick Cheney called that process, democracy building, nation building. There is another soft kind deployed increasingly with some modern techniques during the Cold War in the 60s and especially in the 70s that took on a new character coming out of the CIA. And we saw manifestations in what Victoria Nuland called one of the greatest moments of U.S. foreign policy, when she celebrated U.S. government spending $5 billion through the National Endowment for Democracy to prepare the groundwork for regime change in Ukraine under what some call the Revolution of Dignity. But really, this was something that's been proven to have been a violent operation that utilized a lot of Nazi paramilitary groups, other mercenaries brought in. Studies have been done showcasing the triangulation of mercenaries stationed as snipers in a certain building above the Maidan that were shooting both cops and protesters. We saw another attempt, but a failure of an attempt. I was actually there at a certain point for a conference in 2019, September, at the height of the Hong Kong protests. Yet another CIA National Endowment for Democracy operation utilizing a lot of dumb, fanatical, romantic young people radicalized in their universities. We saw this come home to roost in the United States in the course of the BLM Black Lives Matter riots, funded again by George Soros and protected by intelligence agencies embedded within the USA itself. Antifa, anti-fascist movements, again funded by Soros and protected by US intelligence, used a lot of the exact same techniques. And again, one of the characteristics that one finds in any color revolution tends to be, in this case, we see here British and American flags at the Maidan. Here again, American flags, more British flags of useful idiot Hong Kongers clamoring away in 2019 and earlier 2015 when they did this the first time, demanding a restoration of the freedoms they once enjoyed under British rule, which, by the way, never had democracy in Hong Kong, had examples in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s where the British had massacred civilians in Hong Kong demanding freedom, the whole thing itself. Why were the British there? It was because they needed Hong Kong as the basis of an international opium war to destroy China intellectually, culturally, spiritually, and HSBC, the drug bank that has been caught laundering money, drug money in the hundreds of billions for decades, was caught red-handed and was found guilty, paid off a few billion dollars to settle the crime that they did, and still to this very day controls a third of the Hong Kong money. Another money laundering bank that's part of the London complex is Standard and Charters, which also manages a big chunk of the Hong Kong monetary system. So that's even to this very day something.
Sorry, I'm just going to jump in just for a moment. Notice how they are wearing masks. This is now 2019.
Yeah, that's interesting, eh? That's it. I mean, the mask wearing culture in China was always kind of there because of the pollution issues. But in this case, this was probably because they didn't want people to see their faces, because a lot of these student protesters were burning people alive. There were many deaths that had happened during that time. It got violent, and they were really trying to provoke, just like in the Ukraine situation or Georgia, like in this case. The technique is to provoke the authorities to use violence. That's always been the idea, to then justify an acceleration of essentially regime change, and use that really as propaganda in the eyes of the international community that would then be induced to clamor and champion foreign militarists that would go in and help a protest movement out, as we saw with Libya, in overthrowing an undesired government, which might be not willing to sabotage their sovereignty on some altar of globalism. So that was done in 2003, and again we see a more recent 2023 re-sparking of that model of color revolution now in Georgia, now that Georgia is trying to push back a little bit against these CIA front groups and Soros front groups by demanding that that every for agency trying to push social change registers as or makes transparent their foreign funding, which there was never a law on such a thing in Georgia. So now there's obviously a reawakening of the milit of these rabble-rousers. Hungary has something similar going on right now, which is concerning. This Taiwan also suffered their own regime change operation in 2014 when the National Endowment for Democracy funded a slightly more peaceful, but still, I mean, they stormed the Capitol building, took over that. On the left is a picture of the Sunflower Movement youth who took control of the Taiwanese parliament building, demanding an end to any economic treaties that were being signed on with mainland China. And with this movement came the creation of a pro-U.S. a pro-U.S. regime that saw the U.S. as supporters of separatism in Taiwan, which is currently being used as a Ukraine of the Pacific today against China. So that's just a few samples of some of what we know color revolutions have done in recent years. There's a lot more examples I didn't throw in here, but just to give people a flavor of what they're going to see with Tiananmen Square. I mentioned National Endowment for Democracy. I mentioned Soros's Open Society Foundations. So just quickly, what are these? Samuel P. Huntington, to understand, even though NED was created officially in 1983 and Open Society Foundation in 1979, the roots of this go back. I think a good starting point is the 1975 Trilateral Commission Task Force on the Governability of Democracies, overseen by Zbigniew Brzezinski. And this particular draft report presented in Kyoto, Japan, at the Trilateral Commission Summit there, was drafted by Samuel P. Huntington, both of whom were Trilateral Commission members, very high level, both of whom were globalists calling for a post-nation-state world order under a technocratic scientific managerial class. Both of them are on record saying so, along with David Rockefeller and Kissinger, two other leading figures who created the Trilateral Commission. Now, in this 1975 report, Huntington writes, one might consider means of securing support and resources from foundations, business corporations, labor unions, political parties, civic associations, and where possible and appropriate, governmental agencies for the creation of an institute for the strengthening of democratic institutions. Sounds all well and good. Okay, but why 75? Well, this is the same year that the Church Committee has occurred, and that also goes with another committee on assassinations by the U.S. government, which put to light a lot of the shadowy dealings of the CIA and FBI, but especially the CIA, in overthrowing governments throughout the 1950s and 60s, assassinating leaders both at home and abroad, MKUltra, Project Mockingbird, COINTELPRO infiltration of domestic civil rights and anti-imperial organizations. All of this was made public, and it was somewhat embarrassing for the CIA at the time, which needed to rebrand their techniques and essentially do the exact same thing that they had been doing that ever since the end of World War II, but rebrand it under something that might look a little bit more pretty for the surface, on the surface. So this was the mandate put forth that created what was known first as the American Freedom Foundation. That was created by Freedom House, the head of Freedom House and the head of the RNC and DNC in 1979 as the first step in creating this umbrella group that would unite civil society, union groups, some governmental money as well. U.S. aid was going to play a big role in that. Same year, 1979, Open Society Foundation created around the same month even. 1983 was the official act passed by Reagan, National Endowment for Democracy, which involved a first step of creating $31 million of funding via these organizations that I list here: U.S. Chamber of Commerce's Center for Private Enterprise, the International Republican Institute, International Democratic Institute, Freedom House, AFL-CIO, Free Trade Union Institute, and as pointed out by a former interim head of the NED in 1991, Dave Ignatius. In an interview, he stated, a lot of what we do today was done covertly 25 years ago by the CIA. So this literally, even from those who were operators, controllers of this, it was openly acknowledged to be doing the exact same thing that the CIA was doing. So one of the core managerial instruments for this, as well as the intellectual blueprints that were used to usher in this new age of regime change, was coordinated through what was known as the Center for International Affairs at Harvard University, otherwise known even at the time in the 1960s when it was created as the CIA of Harvard. Henry Kissinger taught there. That's where In that function, Henry Kissinger trained a young sociopathic peon named Klaus Schwab, who was studying there at the time, who went on to be employed to be a cardboard cutout for a certain organization in 1971 that I think viewers are aware of. The other founders, not only was Henry Kissinger a co-founder and a teacher at this, while he was also a director at the Rockefeller Brothers, or he was a director at the Rockefeller Foundation. You had people like McGeorge Bundy, the head of the Ford Foundation, who also co-founded and managed this. James Perkins, a man who would go on to become director of the CIA. We know of Zbigniew Brzezinski, Samuel P. Huntington, Dean Rusk, a major handler he was the president. Dean Rusk was not only a Rhodes Scholar from Oxford, a president of the Rockefeller Foundation. He also managed a big chunk of the Vietnam War and earlier Korean Wars, as the U.S. was turned from being a pro-nation state, pro-freedom, anti-imperial society into a branch of the British Empire under the Five Eyes. So that's what this was.
It's always the same names.
Yeah. Yeah, there's very few who are, I think, given who are vetted to have the permission to see what the whole picture is. Most people are assigned a very compartmentalized task as a peon, as an instrument within the machine. And so when you get a Kissinger or a McGeorge Bundy, they're allowed to see how the game is played. But there's very few in that executive grouping of the nerve centers. I think Gene Sharp is one of those people who was granted the right to see what the whole is doing as well. He also worked at the Center for International Affairs. Gene Sharp also coordinated a sub-organization called the Albert Einstein Institute, both of which, including the Harvard CIA, were coordinated from the, as I mentioned here, as an outgrowth of the Office of the Chief of Psychological Warfare and Special Operations at the CIA, same part of the CIA that was running and managing MKUltra. As well as the entire UFO cult, for that matter, too, the entire growth of the UFO cult since the 50s, run and managed by the same people promoting the drug culture that was then normalized under the hippies. Not two separate things. That's one operation. So Gene Sharp, he's sort of the guru. His handbooks are used to train regime change operatives under color revolutions everywhere in the world today and for the past 40 years. We're going to see more of him. He was also a figure who was on the ground at Tiananmen Square for 9 days during the actual protest itself. I have mentioned Henry Kissinger. So I love context. People often get so sucked into the mechanics of things and they start looking myopically at the machinery of conspiracies that they very often lose sight of the whole picture. And I think context is everything. So just to avoid falling into that trap today, I think it's useful to just review 1974. Henry Kissinger's National Security Study Memorandum 200 kind of laid out, and it was classified and declassified only in 1991. It laid out, I think, the general core agenda or the operating system that was being brought online and taking over the United States and the Western world over the dead bodies of John F. Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and many others. And so he says in this is what brings on the idea of making the priority for U.S. foreign policy to be based upon undermining the existence of the sovereign nation state system and pushing a population reduction strategy instead of pro-development, which had formerly been the ethos for most of the moral U.S. citizens and even policymakers in many ways, was to always look to see how we could help Africa, help colonialized, oppressed people develop full-spectrum economies, access the most advanced technology, and do it themselves. That was always part of what made America good. So Kissinger lays out, and I should say Sir Henry Kissinger, because he was knighted by the Queen 25 years later. That's an important point. He says here, is the U.S. prepared to accept food rationing to help people who cannot and will not control their population growth? The U.S. economy will require large and increasing amounts of minerals from abroad, especially from less developed countries. That fact gives the U.S. enhanced interest in the political, economic, and social stability of the supplying countries. Wherever a lessening of population pressures through reduced birth rates can increase the prospects for such stability, population policy becomes relevant to resource supplies and to the economic interests of the United States. Although population pressure is obviously not the only factor involved, these types of frustrations are much less likely under conditions of slow or zero population growth. He names 14 target countries, Mexico, Ethiopia, Egypt, Sri Lanka, on his list of target countries that had been silly enough to want modernization and development back when he was writing, but must learn by force even that their priority must be on reducing, on zero population growth or even negative population growth in order to access the resources under their soil, which is in the strategic interest of the United States. This is known as Malthusianism. So just quick, the ideology of empire is and always has been, even before Malthus himself was born and became an agent of the British East India Company. It was always control people and control the ideas that you permit for people to have in order to keep people voluntarily or forcefully, if possible, subject to their shackles as talking cattle. So on the left is the innovation by Thomas Malthus that made for the scientific management of society a thing of empire, where he put forth a formula saying that human population will always grow geometrically, which is the curve on the right. The curve on the left side that says population, as that population increases, there is scarcity. There's going to be less food to go around. There's going to be more war, more famine, more death. And so enlightened elites must always use these tools of wars and famine and starvation and disease in order to induce the population to always be much lower than the resources that are available and must be controlled by that same elite. This was revived under what's known as the Club of Rome, an organization very closely tied to David Rockefeller's Trilateral Commission and the World Economic Forum, that produced a report called The Limits to Growth that revived the Malthusian mathematical formula for controlling population, added a few more variables with the 1970s computing technology, and used that as a way to sort of shape international policy. And Kissinger was a major, major advocate for this, as was Klaus Schwab, who provided a venue at Davos in 73 to make this popular internationally. The Chinese are attacked often for having a one-child policy, which we are told is at the basis of what the empire wants to do for everybody, is what China did to itself in the 1970s. That was actually not a Chinese policy. Kissinger was, China's overpopulation issues were always a target by Kissinger, which was in Kissinger's mind when he organized the opening up of China. And the idea was to create a slave society whereby China would be the slave cheap labor exporter for the rest of the world, and the rest of the world, or the first world, so-called, was going to become the consumer society that would no longer produce what it once produced for itself. And that way China would stay poor, too poor to buy their own cheap goods. We would stay too decadent and stupid and useless to be able to produce for ourselves. And the only people who would benefit were those who Kissinger worked for at the Bilderberger Group. Keep in mind, Kissinger was on the steering committee of the Bilderberger Group, which I believe he still is to this very day. So that's the logic of closed systems as opposed to open systems. Closed systems create scarcity and forbid the growth of any new discoveries, new inventions that would leap beyond the limits to growth. That's the closed system forces those constraints. The open system, which was expressed by the best of humanity, John F. Kennedy, Lincoln, and so many other leaders, we're always thinking about how do we leap above the limits to growth? How do we encourage more creative discoveries that are then translated into new technologies that create new resources that uplift people from low to high standards of living? So who are the main characters in China? So as China's, it's the limits to growth, the Club of Rome that goes to China. Their mathematical models are what are brought into China as a precondition for China getting access to the vital factories and other industrial needs that China needs, because they were essentially a third world country in the 1950s and in the 60s under the Cultural Revolution of the Gang of Four. They really self-mutilated quite badly. There was a lot of reconstruction that needed to be done, and that required industrial power. They didn't have it. So the Chinese, there's a fight over what would it look like? So obviously We had the Kissinger ideology of the Trilateral Commission, slave society forever. When this was brought to China and the One Child policy was brought in, it wasn't just that, but there was a broader 1980s massive liberalization that also came in. And you had people like Milton Friedman, who made many, many tours of China in the 1980s. There you have Alvin Toffler. We're going to see more of him, a major transhumanist futurist who also made many tours of China, working with CIA operatives who were very high level inside of the Chinese Communist Party. Soros opened up several front groups inside of China in the 1980s, too, coordinating very closely with the CIA. This figure is going to play an important part of the Tiananmen Square story. And Zhao Ziyang, who you and I have spoken briefly about in the past, is there with Ronald Reagan. He was known as the Gorbachev of China, the great liberalizer. Milton Friedman and Toffler and many others saw him as Soros, saw him as the man who was going to be, who needed to become the new Pinochet. Keep in mind, you know, when Pinochet was put in power in Chile in the 1970s by Kissinger after the overthrow of Salvador Allende, what did Pinochet, the dictator, do? He liberalized the economy, right? He also killed thousands and thousands of resistance fighters and intellectuals, but he also liberalized and privatized the Chilean economy and opened up the free markets, got rid of all protectionism. And that's really what they wanted in the case of China, a privatization, just like they were preparing in the case of Russia. So Zhao Ziyang was premier from 1980 to 87, and from 87 to 89, he was the general secretary of the Chinese Communist Party. A lot of Chinese don't like talking about him because it's a bit of an embarrassment to see to what degree the CIA and Soros had control of China in the 1980s. One of the things that Zhao Ziyang said, and this is in my new report with that I co-wrote with my wife, Breaking Free of Anti-China PSYOPs, Zhao Ziyang in October 9th, 1983. I believe this was at a Trilateral Commission summit in Beijing, overseen by David Rockefeller. He writes, whether we call it the Fourth Industrial Revolution or call it the Third Wave, these writers, and here he's referring to Alvin Toffler and the writers who were then promoting the Fourth Industrial Revolution around Klaus Schwab, all believe that Western countries in the 1950s and 60s reached a high degree of industrialization and are now moving to an information society. At the end of this century and at the beginning of the next century, or within a few decades, there will be a new kind of situation in which breakthroughs in new technology that are happening now or will happen soon will be used for production and for society. For us and for the future of the four modernizations, this is both an opportunity and a challenge. Okay, so it sounds kind of nice on the surface. Okay, technology, new advanced technologies being used for the benefit of humanity, all sounds good. But what is this? What is he actually talking about? Well, in this case, he's representing one of two perspectives of what the four modernizations should be. And luckily, Zhao Ziyang, I'll blow a bit of the punchline, ends up in prison when the Maidan of 1989 fails. He ends up in house arrest, I should say. And the opposing faction around Deng Xiaoping, who had put the Gang of Four in prison, had their idea of the four modernizations dominate and become victorious, which is what has shaped Chinese thinking in terms of how to invest in infrastructure, science, technology, and beyond over the past 25 or 30 years. At the time, though, there was still a dispute over whether it would be based upon using things like bioengineering of human babies, information tech along the lines of what we see from the U.S. military industrial complex and big tech today, and effectively a technocratic management of using technology in order to manage the human herd. That was another view of the four modernizations. That's the side that Zhao Ziyang was trying to advance and take over through what's known as the third wave. So Alvin Toffler, he was really big in China. He was actually really big in the United States too. A big chunk of the neoconservative movement of the 1970s. Newt Gingrich was a big advocate and follower of Toffler. Toffler himself was very, very closely tied to Tavistock and its branch outlets in Stanford in America in the 1960s. Toffler laid it out in his third wave in 1978, where he said this era is now screeching to a halt, meaning the industrial national era. He said industrial civilization is now in a state of terminal crisis, and a new radically different civilization is emerging to take its place on the world stage. we are swiftly entering a new, more sophisticated state of evolutionary development based on far more advanced, yet more appropriate technologies than any known so far. Of course, windmills, solar panels, appropriate technologies. This leap to a new phase of history is bringing with it new energy patterns, new geopolitical arrangements, new social institutions, new communications and information networks, new belief systems, symbols and cultural assumptions. Thus, it must generate wholly new political structures and processes. In this sense, the breakdown of government as we have known it, which is to say representative government, is chiefly a consequence of obsolescence. So basically saying representative republican forms of government are outdated, no longer apply to the modern age. That breakdown has to happen. Simply put, the political technology of the industrial age is no longer appropriate technology for the new civilization taking form around us. Our politics are obsolete. Hubris. But I mean, this is the thing. These guys are, that's how they talk. They act like it's an evolutionary force of nature, which they're instruments of. There's no point resisting. Just like Malthus said, it's overpopulation is a force of nature. You can't really escape it by encouraging new discoveries. All you can do is adapt. Or the social Darwinists or eugenicists. All you can do is have an ubermenschen class of managers, of scientific engineers who can manage the depopulated human cattle, the useless eaters, using whatever technology we have available to do that. Very, very arrogant, and it completely betrays the fact that these guys are sociopathic, sick death cultists who actually misanthropically hate human beings for what we actually do when we're in a loving, rational phase, a state of mature being, which is make discoveries, love each other, find peaceful solutions to problems. That's the human way. These people try to say, no, human beings are just a beast against beast. And thus, because we live in a human zoo of each against all in a Hobbesian frenzy, all we can do is have a zookeeper, the Leviathan, right? That can impose a will of order from above. Bullshit. So first wave in this transhumanist formula, first wave of human civilization was agricultural, feudal, pre-national. Second wave under the Toffler transhuman formula was industrial, democratic, national. Came out in the wake of the Renaissance. But now the new third wave that we're entering into is a information society, a technocratic, feudal, post-nation state society. That's the idea. And you can see it in the writings of Zbigniew Brzezinski, of Kissinger, of Huntington. All of them. They all think the same stupid way. All right, so let's now return back to the ground. The ground of China in 1989. So I mentioned before WikiLeaks, 2011, there was a batch of WikiLeaks documents utilizing cables that had been classified by the U.S. Embassy in Beijing during the unfolding of the events between April and especially June of 1989. That revealed that indeed even the U.S. officials on the ground acknowledged through eyewitness accounts and other things that there was actually never a massacre. There was no violent crackdown by the Chinese government against the peaceful protesters. It just didn't happen. What you instead have is an admission that cites interviews by the Chilean embassy on the ground, the ambassador and the diplomats. There were several diplomats on the ground at Tiananmen Square during the worst of it, as we are told, who acknowledged actually that there was a peace negotiation between the soldiers and the student protest leaders to leave peacefully, which they did. And that's acknowledged by those who were witnessing it on the ground and cited by the U.S. officials from, but then made classified because the media is not supposed to know about this. They from the very beginning, even before Tiananmen Square even happened, they were already preparing the mythology. Just like today, the trucker convoy was an insurrection of Nazis. They've prepared the mythology even before there was a trucker's convoy. The same thing for the January 6th events. You know, there's historians from Chatham House deployed days after January 6th to try to paint the narrative for future historians to look back and interpret what happened on January 6th, 2020 as a civil war, an insurgency to take over the government violently by neo-Nazis and Confederates. That's the way the sort of thing goes.
Yeah, which is complete nonsense.
Complete nonsense. It's all myth-making. There was violence, However, that violence, if one looks at the actual evidence of where it took place, there wasn't one but two. So on the main protest were more than 2 months long. It began in the wake of the death of Hu Yaobang, who was the chair and general secretary of the Chinese Communist Party, a reformer who died. So originally it was a memorial of students getting together and memorializing his death in 1989, in April 15th. And then it was recognized that with all of these young bodies firmly in place, we can make these bodies move in a certain way, kind of like a mob, if they're given certain nudges and prompts and manipulation. So you had actual honest students who were there protesting for a better way. You know, there was inflation because of the Milton Friedman reforms. Milton Friedman's liberalized reforms were going rampant. You know, as I didn't mention this, but George Soros had been providing scholarships to thousands of young talent from China to go and get indoctrinated in Western universities and redeployed back to become reformers, just like we had going on in Russia. And the effects of these reforms, just like they would be felt later on in Russia, were a destruction of the stability of the Chinese currency. Inflation was running amok. It was making it difficult to pay to live as a student or as a laborer. And then you had actual laborers on January 4th who also, about 7 kilometers away from the Tiananmen Square, which is where the blue circle is where you had a bunch of laborers who also began to protest. Now, the laborers were much more infused with a lot of violent provocateurs, people who were armed with assault rifles, with thousands of Molotov cocktails. And we saw the same thing within the student body itself as well, but there weren't as many of those. So then you had honest laborers, and you had provocateurs, other agencies that were there to really create an uproar. For the most part, it was, like I said, cultivated by the CIA. And even in 1992, the Vancouver Sun had an article. You know, there's thousands of these citations. I'm just going through a few, where they acknowledged that the Central Intelligence Agency had sources among the Tiananmen Square protesters. And for months before the protest, the CIA had been helping student activists from the anti-government movement. Some of the key figures, a lot of the key student leaders of Tiananmen Square were trained in Hong Kong, funded by people like Jimmy Lai of Apple Media, Apple Daily, who was a big backer of the 2019 Hong Kong protests. He was also one of the big backers back then of the Tiananmen Square protests and provided a groundwork to train a bunch of these young people under a fellow named Colonel Robert Helvey, who is the worked with Gene Sharp very closely at the Albert Einstein Institute and the CIA at Harvard. Helvey is somebody who he was an officer of the Defense Intelligence Agency at the Pentagon. He trained leaders of many protests, including Utpor in Serbia, Kmare in Georgia in 2003, Pora in Ukraine in 2004, the Czechoslovakia Velvet Revolution of 1989. That Colonel Helvey was also on the grounds. And he's somebody who is very, very present in the buildup to the Tiananmen Square operation. That's an image of him on the upper, right beside the Screaming Lady. That's a book by Gene Sharp, Dictatorship or to Democracy. It's been used in Iran. It's been used in Venezuela by the Guaido NED-funded democracy groups in Venezuela that so far have failed, largely because China and Russia have intervened in a variety of ways to help Maduro stay in control. We've seen in Kazakhstan. We see it all across the Arab Spring. We saw it everywhere. We saw it big time in China. So on the right-hand side is Gene Sharp, and to the left of him is the poster for a film about Gene Sharp. That's a useful film to watch. It's a fluff piece called How to Start a Revolution, Meet the Most Important Man You Have Never Heard Of. On the bottom left-hand side is the CIA, or somebody who's a very high-level CIA officer working very closely with George Bush Sr. at the CIA, a skull and bones man from Yale named James Lilly. At the time of Tiananmen Square, he had been and was the U.S. ambassador to China, and he was a major handler and coordinator of Tiananmen Square. Gene Sharp, like I said, was on the ground at Tiananmen for 9 days, as was Helvey was based in Hong Kong. All at the time, Hong Kong was still firmly under the control of British intelligence. It was still part of the British actually, in some ways, it, as I mentioned earlier with HSBC, it still is to a certain degree, but the control by mainland China is much greater today over Hong Kong than it was even 4 years ago, and especially 30 years ago. Some figures that were there on the ground, pictures were taken of people like John Pomfret and Alan Pessin. Pessin was a figure who worked very high up with Voice of America. He was a Voice of America correspondent, always coordinating with the leaders of the Tiananmen Square uprising on the ground every day, John Pomfret. Today, he's with the Washington Post as a propagandist. At the time, he was with Associated Press. Again, both of these people are always with the leading shapers. One of the other leading shapers of Tiananmen Square was the self-professed student commander-in-chief, is what she called herself, Chai Ling. In May 28th, before January 4th, she gives an interview with Philip Cunningham, which can be watched online. There's a documentary called Keys to the Heavenly Kingdom, a 1990s documentary, which is not bad. That actually showcases a big chunk of this interview, where she says, "The students kept asking me, what should we do next? What can we accomplish? I felt so sad, because how can I tell them that what we are actually hoping for is bloodshed? For the moment when the government has no choice but to brazenly butcher the people, i.e. the students." So they want that moment when they give the government no choice but to get violent. "Only when the square is awash with blood will the people of China open their eyes. Only then will they be really united. But how can I explain this to my fellow students? I cannot say all this to my fellow students. I cannot tell them straight out that we must use our blood and our lives to call on the people to rise up. Of course, the students will be willing, but they are still such young children." She herself is a student. "And what is truly sad is that some students and famous well-educated people are working hard to help the government to prevent it from taking such measures. For the sake of their selfish interests and their private dealings, they are trying to cause our movement to collapse and get us out of the square before the government becomes so desperate that it has to, that it takes action." Then when Philip Cunningham asks her, "Well, would you be willing to die for this cause?" She actually says, without blinking an eye, "No, no, I am too important to die. the movement needs leadership." It's always a test of somebody's character when you hear somebody advocating overpopulation and the need to kill off, you know, the excess useless eaters. Ask them if they're the first to volunteer for their yes. noble cause, and yeah, no. Up until late May 1989, the sorts of images one would see from the unarmed, largely unarmed, and these soldiers generally had like billy clubs at most, riot gear at most, at the worst of it, which was acknowledged by the WikiLeaks cables. You tended to see a lot of just harmony. You had moments and videos of the soldiers even singing with the youth, being given food by the youth on the ground. There's a lot of good negotiation, like I said. There's general harmony, and when things really got violent, and I'm going to show you some very disturbing pictures, it's going to get sick. There were deaths at Tiananmen Square. There were innocent deaths, but there was nowhere near the thousands we were told. If anything, estimates that I've seen that are using actual evidence instead of just making numbers up posit that maybe at max a few hundred civilians died, along with a few hundred, 200 to 300 PLA soldiers. I don't even know if that many civilians actually did die. It's very hard to find evidence, but certainly the numbers that we are being given are a lie. It got violent fast, and most of that violence was, like I said, 7 kilometers away from Tiananmen Square, where I mentioned earlier, I showed that image, the map. You have cases where we're not shown in Western media of protesters that lit the tanks on fire, that lit buses on fire. These are PLA Chinese buses with the Chinese officials that were lit on fire, in many cases with the doors jammed up and then the people inside burnt to death. That's a PLA soldier who was strangled to death and lit on fire, outside of one of the many buses. Many tanks that were brought in were all lit on fire. In some cases, the tank drivers were sealed in and burnt to death. Many trucks, many cars, hundreds were lit on fire. Another picture of another PLA soldier lit on fire and choked to death, and more cases of PLA soldiers. These are two more hanging off the side of these trucks and then burnt alive. More case of PLA soldiers burnt alive, one hanging from an overpass on the right. Very, very disturbing. There's many more pictures like this, unfortunately, and it turns my stomach, but it's important for people to make this. It makes it real for people. It's not just my words. This is a screenshot from what's known openly as Operation Yellowbird. I think a racistly named operation coordinated by MI6, the CIA, and Hong Kong triads, as it's titled there, how Tiananmen activists fled to freedom through Hong Kong. This is one thing covered by the China Morning Post, the South China Morning Post. People can even go to Operation Yellowbird on even Wikipedia if they want to get even the official story of what this was. And as I said, it was the cooperation with Hong Kong triads and leading MI6 and CIA operatives and also embassy staff around James Lilley to provide support and protection to the rat line, just like we had, Nazis from the used the rat line after World War II, you know, and installed in positions of comfort in South America, advising governments, running terror campaigns under Operation Gladio during the Cold War. The same sort of rat line happened, and this is what Gavin Newsom, a journalist with, I believe, the Washington Post, called the formation of an anti-government protest movement in as expats internationally, primarily based in New York, in Florida, and especially in Vancouver and Toronto, who were given sanctuary. Here we're talking about the leading violent controllers of the worst of that protest. And this includes also that girl, Chai Ling, who was also, she escaped through Operation Yellowbird and received sanctuary, Ivy League scholarships. And I think to this very day, one would find, if you look at the controllers of such synthetic cults as Falun Gong, whose leader, Li Hongji, has a 400-acre estate in New York protected by the CIA as the center of an international web of operations, including cultural Epoch Times as one branch of this, as far as a Five Eyes-managed psychological warfare operation to create false narratives and confuse the hell out of people trying to make sense of how this conspiracy works. So I think you'd find many of those traitors from the 80s probably playing in some positions of interest there. That's just for Amazing. People to think about. Yeah. One thing from Wikipedia, Operation Yellowbird was a British Hong Kong-based operation to help the Chinese dissidents who participated in Tiananmen Square protests of 1989 to escape arrest by the Chinese government by facilitating their departure overseas via Hong Kong. Western intelligence agencies such as Britain's Secret Intelligence Service, MI6, and the U.S. CIA were involved in the operations. Other contributors included politicians, celebrities, business people, and triad members from Hong Kong. Formerly the unlikely alliance, or forming the unlikely alliance, which sustained the operation for most of its duration. One key figure who today is being used in a very virulent way as part of, I'm sure everyone's noticed an amplification of anti-Chinese, kind of like what the liberals were given under Donald Trump's, the Trump years of Russiagate, this frenzied reamplification of a narrative that Russia has taken over and infiltrated our governments using their puppet Trump to undermine our democracy and give rise to white supremacist domestic terror movements run by the Kremlin. A lot of the conservatives have been profiled psychologically because it's I find a vicious irony that they recognize the fraud of those Russiagate arguments, but at the same time, the exact same model has been used and deployed, especially over the last few years, against China. Again, to get us to look away from the role of MI6, the City of London, the actual core of the oligarchy, which has been trying to destroy the United States and Russia and China, running an international deep state. People are told to look away from that and instead focus your fear and anger energy using controlled narratives and reframing. A lot of neuro-linguistic programming is used for the reframing of narratives to make the boogeyman China. Police stations abroad and foreign interference in the Canadian elections and control of Joe Biden and blah, blah, blah. It goes on forever. So all that to say, Miles Guo is a character that you see there with Steve Bannon. He's a multi-billionaire, one of the richest men in China, or was. He was in prison. He was one of the key leaders of the student protest. Not even the student protest. He was actually one of the more violent. Anyway, he's a provocateur. And he provided a lot of funding, a lot of financing and direction and logistic support, along with Jimmy Lai on the right-hand side with Nancy Pelosi, who's now actually in prison, who was the primary money bags behind, as I mentioned, the Hong Kong protests in 2019 and 2015. And he was a big supporter and backer of the 1989 regime change effort. So Miles Guo went to prison for 2 years in 1990. When he got out, there was still something very powerful and evil inside of China that had not been extracted, which began to help him reconstruct or construct a bit of an empire in real estate and investment banking. He became the representative of the a Chinese branch of JP Morgan in China in the 1990s, all the way up until his near arrest. He avoided arrest during Xi Jinping's anti-corruption crackdown, which has been ongoing now for 10 years. He just narrowly avoided arrest because he had the protection of two key figures within the Chinese state security complex, who also went to jail, actually, and I'll say something about them, in 2015. And he made it straight to the United States with a letter of recommendation from Tony Blair, which allowed him to buy a $60 million penthouse suite in New York. And he began bankrolling things like Steve Bannon's war room. Miles Guo also announced with Bannon on the anniversary of January 4th, the Tiananmen Square thing, the creation of what's known as the Federal State of New China in 2020 as a fake new replacement state for China, which would be, of course, overseen by Miles Guo. And that would somehow coordinate an international body of expat Chinese. And, you know, hopefully they wanted to cultivate, you know, fifth columnists that were there. It's still in China to overthrow Xi Jinping and reinstall him as the sort of new Chilean Pinochet or Trotsky or however you want to call it, the new Zhao Jiang of China. That's sort of at least the ambition. On the right-hand side, like I said, you got people like not only Nancy Pelosi provoking a war with China and provoking separatism in Taiwan. She just went there not that long ago. But figures in the neocon groupings around John Bolton are also doing the same thing. So it's not a left versus right thing. This is what it is. I mentioned JP Morgan. So Connie Morgan did a broadcast in support of the anniversary of Tiananmen Square. And in it, Connie Morgan is the heiress to the JP Morgan fortune. That's Connie Morgan. Connie Morgan is a close supporter of the Federal State of New China. And in this broadcast with Jimmy Lai, she goes through a defense of JP Morgan as the great patriotic banking operation of America, who've been wrongfully slandered by haters who don't realize how amazing JP Morgan is as a patriot movement. And there you have Miles Guo recapitulating her remarks to the audience, saying, "Mrs. Morgan has made it very clear there were no stakeholders from Morgan family in Federal Reserve, nor did they get involved with deep state. So this is rumor. Morgan family is real patriots for America." That's Miles Guo. That's Epoch Times. So the other figures, you got to keep in mind. So there has been China has been working extra hard over the past 10 years to do battle and extract the WEF, the World Economic Forum managed deep state. I mentioned Zhao Jiang was put under house arrest in the weeks after the Tiananmen 4 operation was put down. Chen Yitzi, Zhao Jiang's right-hand man, co-ran a think tank with George Soros. The Institute for Economic and Structural Reform of China. That's a Soros operation co-run by Chen Yitzi, who is also, I believe, he escaped through Operation Yellowbird to America, where he later on, he more recently died. You had thousands who were imprisoned. You had thousands who escaped. You had the CIA open several NED operations in front offices in 1988 in preparation for this, this moment of regime change. Under the last 10-year administration of Xi Jinping, there has been such a crackdown, and Miles Guo would have it, would try to interpret the events of this crackdown as though Xi Jinping is the evil representative of the CPC that's controlling Klaus Schwab and that runs George Soros, that has overthrown the U.S. elections against Trump in 2020. And they're obviously trying to, that you have to live with a lot of self-contradictions and paradoxes if you believe this. But when you look at the people that have actually gone to jail, we are talking about two controllers, two former handlers of this asshole, Ma Jian, vice minister of public security, kind of like the Chinese CIA, has been given life imprisonment in 2016. Zhou Yongkang, the official minister of public security from 2002 to 2007, another handler of Miles Guo, was given life imprisonment in 2016. Ling Ji Hua, chief of staff of Hu Jintao, the former premier of China, was given life imprisonment in 2016. Sun Jingkai, a Politburo member, was given life in 2018, all for very serious corruption charges. Fu Zhenghua, the former justice minister, was given life in prison in 2021. Meng Hongwei was given 13.5 years in prison. This is the former Interpol chief of China. This is the deep state. These are the people who work with the Shanghai clique of billionaires that were brought up and created by Kissinger, Alvin Toffler, Zhao Ziyang in the 80s and continue to have influence throughout the 90s to this very day. This is the part you can't understand what the hell the Shanghai lockdown was until you think on this level of how this was going to be the center of a new Hong Kong style color revolutionary uprising with the support of this deep state network of billionaires that had to be purged and cleansed, which happened during the course of the Shanghai lockdown. So what they're telling the people, the plebs who don't really know much about what reality is versus the actual players who are fighting and making history happen are two different stories, okay? And that's something people have to sort of internalize, because, you know, your average, you know, blue-collar Joe who has been to community college just doesn't have an awareness of the actual nature of these struggles throughout history. And that's really something important to hold in mind, is that there is a fight to purge this deep state, which is why John Bolton complained in an interview to Bloomberg News saying that it's no longer possible through China's authoritarian use of social credit programs, social credit policies, and the surveillance operation, they're not able to maintain their CIA operatives the way that they were used to. It doesn't mean that social credit and these things are good. No, they're not good. It's just that there's a need for, like, that's what confuses people when they look at the centralized nature of China's planned economy. They think that's evil because the evil people who want to create a dictatorship also want centralized planning in a controlled economy, except the difference is that the ideological framework and the moral value system of the Klaus Schwab, Henry Kissinger death cultists is to create scarcity for a Malthusian population reduction scheme, whereas people who are also using central government power to do things like John F. Kennedy or Lincoln or Franklin Roosevelt or George Washington, I mean, there's a lot of examples throughout history where power itself is like a neutral thing. It's the question of, do you have the moral, intellectual value structure to use power to defend humanity against oligarchy, or do you want to use that power to enslave and kill, destroy people on behalf of oligarchy? Itself is a tool, right? A knife or a fire can burn or cut for good or for bad, you know? So that's what government is. Government's like a technology. It's central government is a very powerful technology. China has been very weak for the past 50 years, especially since the self-mutilation of the Cultural Revolution. And before that, the Century of Humiliation, it was one of the most wrecked countries under foreign globalist influence. And they have not made the policies of the Fourth Industrial Revolution. They didn't make any of the policies of the social credit system. What has happened, though, has been they didn't make the one-child policy. That came in, that was forced into them by Kissinger and the Club of Rome. What's happened now is that they're working. There's evidence that they're actually fighting back, creating abundance. Just look at the massive increase of standards of living And this is what I always tell people, is look at the actual what's being done in practical economic terms. China has pulled out 1 billion people from poverty in 20 years. We have only created poverty under the IMF and World Bank. They've pulled that out, but they've also pulled, they went from having 3% of their population living in the middle income bracket in 1999 to 56% today. Their longevity has been consistently increasing year to year, to the point that today there's 79.8 years of age on average for a Chinese life expectancy versus 76.2 years of age for Americans, which has been consciously collapsing. One of the things is that when you're going into battle, and I look at this like kind of hand-to-hand combat occurring over decades, is that if your enemy, like think of playing a video game, if you're battling somebody in a video game, right, and that character you're battling all of a sudden generates a giant weapon that you don't have, if you don't develop some form of symmetrical power to counteract it, your enemy is going to wipe you down. Now, in the case, that's a short video game. You can see it in hand-to-hand combat or mixed martial arts. You know, if you don't tend to see a new power occur in the course of a physical mixed martial art or karate game, or a bout of karate. That's not the case. But in the case of nations fighting, it's occurring over years and decades and longer. And so if your enemy is coming at you with a new centralized power that they intend to use to destroy you, if you don't generate some reciprocal response of a similar type of power, you cannot defend yourself. So I think that's the way I tend to look at China's, the things that are the most distasteful about China's governance and economic policies, specifically the social credit stuff, is to look at it within the framework of this fight for global depopulation, how they've lifted the one population, the one child policy, they lifted it to two, then three. Now it's at three, soon it's going to be at nothing, because they're trying to heal themselves from the self-mutilation they did. So all that to say, and also peace, right? Like where empires always create divide to conquer forever wars, rivalries against between neighbors. Look at whatever China has done in the Middle East. As soon as you get the United States military out of the Middle East, China goes in with diplomatic brilliance, creating peace policies between Saudi Arabia and Iran and Turkey and Syria and the whole, you know, Gulf region, which is now brought back into the Arab League. And same thing for Africa. So it's just a very different paradigm of thinking about using a system, a top-down systems control, systems management, but one based upon creative change, leaping over the limits to growth, creating more abundance, whereas the operating system of the Club of Rome that's shaping our world in the West is based on creating scarcity, getting us to adapt like animals to less and less and eating bugs and blah, blah, blah. So
what you're telling me is that the Tiananmen Square massacre is essentially a product of Western propaganda, anti-China propaganda.
In effect, yes. Human beings are funny creatures, right? And there's a bit of a most animals they live according to the mandate of their genetics and environment, and they just are what they are, and that's fine. And human beings are the creature that generates ideas, and we're the creature that tells stories, and that's how we sort of get a sense of meaning and causality, which other animals, my cat has no question about what does it mean to be a cat? What's the purpose of being a cat? It's happy being what it is, you know. Human beings have this other deeper yearning for the beyond, the eternal, you know, the higher truths, the higher realities. And so stories are an important part of that, where we generate metaphors. We see with the mind's eye, but it's tied also to feelings. It's not just logic. And it's a great power if wielded with wisdom that's the way Jesus was able to organize so effectively, is he was a storyteller, you know, and he took very deep philosophical concepts, but wrap them in allegory and metaphor, using mustard seeds and was able to communicate something high impact that was true using something so simple. But then if you have a dishonest misanthrope who becomes aware of this technology, this power, it could do a lot of damage, like we see with the CIA's control of so many of our Hollywood movies and Netflix programming. It's predictive programming for the 99% of what we're being fed, right? In order to shape our sense of what humanity is, what the future is. I mean, there's all sorts of Trojan horses slipped into the scripts and stories funded by the CIA and MI6 in order to make us more docile, more detached from our true nature, more inclined to adapt like animals to unnatural dystopic future states. Instead of righting wrongs, we adapt to them or try to just look out for ourselves in some survival against zombies or something, which is the worst way to think about moving into a crisis, is everybody looking out for themselves, like many, which is the ethic for many of those Netflix films, right? That yeah. showcase people trying to survive in a post-apocalyptic world. There's no place for agopic love or moral value or solving big problems the way Martin Luther King was doing. There's no place for that, for the heart to grow.
Using very simple language, please summarize this conversation.
Yeah.
In just one paragraph or two. Yeah. A soundbite, if you will.
Okay. We are being weaponized against those countries who are doing the greatest battle against the oligarchy. And most of us who are good-hearted, want a good future for our friends and family and children and nations, we, because of certain facts of history, like Tiananmen Square, which we are ignorant of, we are going along with stories that are causing us to support wars against, again, those countries who are resisting the depopulation agenda, which we would be better off working with and organizing to collaborate with as partners against this common enemy, which is an embedded hereditary power structure that goes back to the days of Rome and Babylon, of inbred oligarchs who are sociopathic death cultists who want to restore global feudalism. That's not China, it ain't Russia, it ain't Venezuela that's doing this. It's something else, it's supranational. And Tiananmen Square is a big, big lie that if we can overcome that and look at the fact that it was actually a regime change operation, not a peace protest or a peace movement, but a regime change operation that failed, we will have a better understanding of how China kicked out George Soros and how we could do the same.
Okay. So if those listening right now to this conversation want to go and get a great reference, I'm guessing it's on your website.
Yeah, people would be pretty good I would recommend picking up the Breaking Free of Anti-China PSYOPs report. It's about 75 pages. There's going to be a part two coming out soon, but that's available on CanadianPatriot.org. And to get a sense of some of the backstory that I mentioned regarding what is the Anglo-Venetian roots of the deep state. Why did I just say Venice? If you don't know how Venice took over Britain, if you don't know that character, how the leading families of the Roman Empire from the Western Roman Empire took control, or at least migrated to Venice to do what they did, where afterwards they then took control of Britain a few centuries later. If you don't know that, you don't really know the nature of the beast. So that's also in my books, Clash of the Two Americas, volumes 1-4, and Untold History of Canada, volumes 1-4. Again, also on my CanadianPatriot.org, and my wife's new book too, on the Anglo-American roots of international fascism, which she just published. Really, really sharp, scary, good read. Also available on my website. They want to go back to the failed agenda of 1930s, when the British City of London hardcore roundtable movement leaders were providing the support, along with a lot of leading American industrialists like Jacob Schiff and Paul Vorberg. The same people that had brought in the Federal Reserve were the same fascist oligarchists who were propping up and causing the growth of the Japanese fascist war machine, which was supposed to be the power that would be controlled or handled by international financiers that would manage the Asian part of the world, especially China, as a slave colony in the Pacific. And that failed, just like, you know, the Germans were supposed to manage the slave colony of Russia under Hitler, and all the Japanese fascists and the Nazis, were all going to be localized managers of regional fake multipolar system under a truly unipolar structure in London as a center command structure. that was supposed to be what World War II was supposed to play out as, or even World War II technically should not have happened under some scenarios. So they just want to bring that back. And that's why the Trilateral Commission was also created with David Rockefeller, the Trilateral Commission representing three powers, the United States, Western Europe, or the Anglo-American zone. Kissinger was knighted, keep in mind. The Anglo-American zone of control, which also includes the Commonwealth, the Five Eyes, Western Europe, which is going to be sort of lower on the rung, and Japan. And Japan was the supposed to be the dominant power controlling regionally the Pacific zone, of and China was supposed to be the slave colony. So that's what they want to bring back. That's what they wanted to bring back in the 80s. They still want to bring that back. That's what they brought into Russia in the 90s. That's what Putin has been fighting against for the past 23 years. So, yeah.
How important in the next few years, in your opinion, is BRICS?
Oh, it's extremely important. It went from being a Goldman Sachs operation, which it was originally. People often forget that it was created by a leading investment banker at Goldman Sachs, which was supposed to be, by its original design, simply a speculative basket case of the major economies that had to be torn down or undermined from within. That would be tied to Brazilian bioethanol speculative bubbles and more easily manipulated. BRICS, I think, by around 2010, 2011, there was a bit more of a takeover of that platform by those who had a different idea of economic value and who saw the need to increase the productive powers of labor, which is why the BRICS, especially in the last 12 years, has moved from being a negligible part of the world economy to becoming now representing more GDP, more buying power even than by far than even the G7 in just the past, 13, 14 years. So that is also causing, because it's based on a different way of doing business, a different philosophy of business and foreign relations, it's attracting a lot of nations. I think now there's about 46 nations who have expressed interest to join up with that. The BRICS Development Bank, the New Development Bank, also has members from Bangladesh and Iran and Turkey is joining up. Saudi Arabia is coming online. Many of the UAE, many African states are waiting in line to jump on board, South American states. So, I mean, for obvious reasons, they're actually building things in the real world that are creating abundance and a better way of life. Whereas in the West, under the IMF and World Bank, we see what damage they've done for 80 years and what they're committed to. So, yeah, BRICS is very important.
Matt, how can I follow your work?
Well, I mentioned the CanadianPatriot.org is a really good website, especially by the books, but also daily updates. There's MatthewErritt.substack.com. That's something if people want to read my daily updates, writing, videos, check that out. I'm currently engaged with a few associates, collaborators, my wife and Jason Dahl and a few others, who are making a series of short videos on breaking free of anti-China psyops. Where the first one's going to be released by tomorrow, debunking the mythology of the global police stations in New York and Canada and Europe that's been promoted by a National Endowment for Democracy front group called Safeguard Defenders. So we're going to break that down in the first video. Then we're going to have something on China election interference in Canada that we're also going to break down, going into like what is really CSIS, what is really the Five Eyes, what are these things that are producing these anonymous reports that were being fed by our mainstream media, which is also being funded by the very liberal government that they're currently saying, the liberal government of Canada, of Justin Trudeau, which they're saying is bought and paid for as a tool of the CPC. It's like, who are these mainstream media patriots and these intelligence agency patriots who care so much about big bad China interference? Are they really trustworthy? What's the sources? What are they using? And so we're going to just dismantle these myths in these 5 to 20 minute videos. So that's something people can watch too. Lastly, I would say risingtidefoundation.net is our my wife and I started that as a nonprofit to promote education, cross-cultural dialogue. So that's another fun website.
Matt Errett, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Always a pleasure, Jeremy. Always a pleasure.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please visit supportjerm.com.